Stop. No, on a bit. Stop. Turn a little bit to the left. I mean, my left. Back a bit. Now, throw your arms up. He walked over to her and followed her gaze. He was shot from the university.
Looks like the library building, said Angua. But a wizard wouldn't do it, surely. They keep out of that sort of thing.
Oh, it's not too hard to get in there, even when the gates are shut, said Carrot. Let's try the unofficial way, shall we?
Okay.
Carrot?
Yes?
The, false moustache. It's not you, you know, and the nose is far too pink.
Doesn't it make me look inconspicuous?
No. And the hat. I should lose the hat, too. It's a good hat, she added quickly, but a brown bowler is not your style. It doesn't suit you.
Exactly, said Carrot. If it was my style, people would know it's me, right?
I mean, it makes you look like a twerp, Carrot.
Do I normally look like a twerp?
No, not...
Aha!
Carrot fumbled in the pocket of his large brown overcoat. I got this book of disguises from the joke shop in Phaedra Road. Look, funny thing, Nobby was in there buying stuff too. I asked him why, and he said it was desperate measures. What do you think he meant by that?
I can't imagine, said Angua.
It's just amazing the stuff they've got. False hair, false noses, false beards, even false...
He hesitated and began to blush.
Even false, you know, chests. For ladies. But I can't imagine for the life of me why they'd want to disguise those.
He probably couldn't, Angua thought. She took the very small book from Carrot and glanced through it. She sighed.
Carrot, these disguises are meant for a potato.
Are they?
Look, they're all on potatoes, see?
I thought that was just for display.
Carrot, it's got Mr. Spuddyface on it.
Behind his thick black moustache, Carrot looked hurt and perplexed.
"What does a potato want a disguise for?" he said.
They'd reached the alley alongside the university that had been known informally as Scholar's Entry for so many centuries that this was now on a nameplate at one end. A couple of student wizards went past. The unofficial entrance to the university has always been known only to students. What most students failed to remember was that the senior members of the faculty had also been students once, and also liked to get out and about after the official shutting of the gates. This naturally led to a certain amount of embarrassment and diplomacy on dark evenings. Carrot and Angua waited patiently as a few more students climbed over, followed by the dean.
"Good evening, sir," said Carrot politely.
"Good evening to you, Spuddy," said the dean, and ambled off into the night.
"You see?"
"Ah, but he didn't call me Carrot," said Carrot. "The principle is sound."
They dropped down onto the lawns of academia and headed for the library.
"It'll be shut," said Angua.
"Remember, we have a man on the inside," said Carrot, and knocked.
The door opened a little way.
"Ooh!"
Carrot raised his horrible little round hat.
"Good evening, sir. I wonder if we could come in. It's watch business."
"Ooh! Ooh! 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 Ooh!"
"What did he say?"
said Angua.
"If you must know, he said, 'My goodness me, a walking potato,'" said Carrot.
The librarian wrinkled his nose at Angua. He did not like the smell of werewolves. But he beckoned them inside and then left them waiting while he knuckled back to his desk and rummaged in a drawer. He produced a watch special constable's badge on a string, which he hung around the general area where his neck should have been, and then stood as much to attention as an orangutan can, which is not a great deal. The central ape gets the idea, but outlying areas are slow to catch on.
"Ooh, ooh, ooh."
"Was that, 'How may I be of assistance, Captain Tuba?'" said Angua.
"We need to have a look on the fifth floor overlooking the square," said Carrot, a shade coldly.
"Ooh, ooh, ooh."
"He says that's just old storerooms," said Carrot.
"And that last ook," said Angua.
"Mr. Horrible Hat," said Carrot.
"Still, he hasn't worked out who you are, eh?" said Angua.
The fifth floor was a corridor of airless rooms, smelling sadly of old unwanted books. They were stacked not on shelves, but on wide racks, bundled up with string. A lot of them were battered and missing their covers. Judging by what remained, though, they were old textbooks that not even the most ardent bibliophile could treasure. Carrot picked up a torn copy of Waddley's Occult Primer. Several loose pages fell out. Angua picked one up.
"Chapter 15,
Elementary necromancy, she read aloud. Lesson one, correct use of shovel. She put it down again and sniffed the air. The presence of the librarian filled the nasal room like an elephant in a matchbox, but... Someone else has been in here, she said, in the last couple of days. Could you leave us, sir? When it comes to odours, you're a bit, forthright.
Ooh?
The librarian nodded at Carrot, shrugged at Angua, and ambled out. Don't move, said Angua. Stay right where you are, Carrot. Don't disturb the air. She inched forward carefully. Her ears told her the librarian was down the corridor because she could hear the floorboards creaking, but her nose told her that he was still here. He was a little fuzzy, but... I'm going to have to change, she said. I can't get a proper picture this way. It's too strange. Carrot obediently shut his eyes. She'd forbidden him to watch her en route from a human to a wolf because of the unpleasant nature of the shapes in between. Back in Überwald, people went from one shape to the other as naturally as ordinary humans would put on a different coat, but even there it was considered polite to do it behind a bush. When he reopened them, Angua was slinking forward, her whole being concentrated in her nose. The olfactory presence of the librarian was a complex shape, a mere purple blur where he had been moving, but almost a solid figure where he'd been standing still. Hands, face, lips. They'd be just the centre of an expanding cloud in a few hours' time, but now she could still smell them out. There must be only the tiniest air currents in here. There weren't even any flies buzzing in the dead air to cause a ripple of disturbance. She edged nearer to the window. Vision was a mere shadowy presence, providing a charcoal sketch of a room over which the scents painted their glorious colours. By the window. By the window, yes. A man had stood there, and by the scent of it he hadn't moved for some time. The smell wavered in the air on the edge of her nasal skill. The curling, billowing traces said that the window had been opened and closed again, and was there just the merest, tiniest suggestion that he'd held an arm out in front of him? Her nose raced, trying to form original shapes from the patterns hanging in the room like dead smoke. When she'd finished, Angua went back to her pile of clothes and coughed politely while she was pulling on her boots. There was a man standing by the window, she said. Long hair, a bit dry, stinks of expensive shampoo. He was the man who nailed the boards back after Rossi got into the barbican. Are you sure? Is this nose ever wrong? Sorry. Go on. I'd say he was heavy set, a bit bulky for his height. He doesn't wash a lot, but when he does, he uses Windpike soap. The cheap brand. But expensive shampoo, which is odd. Quite new boots and a green coat. You can smell the colour? No, the dye. It comes from Stolat, I think. And I think he shot a bow. An expensive bow. There's a hint of silk in the air, and that's what the strongest bowstrings are made of, isn't it? And you wouldn't put one of those on a cheap bow. Carrot stood by the window. He got a good view, he said, and looked down at the floor, and then at the sill, and on the shelves nearby. How long was he here? 2 or 3 hours, I'd say. He didn't move around much. No. Or smoke, or spit. He just stood and waited. A professional. Mr. Vimes was right.
A lot more professional than Ozzy, said Angua.
Green coat, said Carrot, as if thinking aloud. Green coat. Green coat.
Oh, and bad dandruff, said Angua, standing up.
Snowy slopes, shouted Carrot.
What?
Really bad dandruff?
Oh, yes, it was.
That's why they called him Snowy, said Carrot. Daceyville Slopes, the man with the reinforced comb. But I'd heard he'd moved to Stolat.
In unison, they said, where the dye comes from.
Is he good with a bow? Said Angua.
Very good. He's good at killing people he never met, too.
He's an assassin, is he?
Oh, no, he just kills people for money. No style. Snowy can't read and write.
Carrot scratched his head in sympathetic recollection. He doesn't even look at complicated pictures. We'd have got him last year, but he shook his head fast and got away while we were trying to dig out Nobby.
Well, well, I wonder where he's staying.
Don't ask me to follow him in these streets. Thousands of people will have walked over the trail.
Oh, there's people who'll know. Someone sees everything in this town.
Mr. Slopes?
Snowy Slopes gingerly felt his neck, or at least the neck of his soul. The human soul tends to keep the shape of the original body for some time after death. Habit is a wonderful thing.
Who the hell was he?
He said.
Not someone you know, said Death.
Well, no. I don't know many people who cut my head off.
Snowy Slopes' body had knocked against the table as it fell. Several bottles of medicated shampoo now dripped and mixed their contents onto the other more intimate fluids from the Slopes' corpse.
That stuff with the special oil in it cost me nearly $4, said Snowy,
yet somehow it all seemed slightly irrelevant now. Death happens to other people. The other person in this case had been him. That is, the one down there, not the one standing here looking at it. In life, Snowy hadn't even been able to spell metaphysical, but he was already beginning to view life in a different way. From the outside, for a start.
$4, he repeated. I never even had time to try it.
It wouldn't have worked, said Death, patting the man on a fading shoulder. But if I might suggest that you look on the bright side, it will no longer be necessary.
No more dandruff, said Snowy,
now quite transparent and fading fast.
Ever, said Death. Trust me on this.
Commander Vimes ran down the darkened streets, trying to buckle on his breastplate as he ran.
All right, Cheery, what's happening?
They say a Clatchian killed someone, sir. There's a mob up in Scandal Alley, and it's looking bad. I was on the desk, and I thought you ought to be told, sir.
Right.
And anyway, I couldn't find Captain Carrot, sir.
A little bit of acid ink scribbled its subtle entry on the ledger of Vimes's soul.
Oh, gods. So who's the officer in charge?
Sergeant Detritus, sir.
It seemed to the dwarf that she was suddenly standing still. Commander Vimes had become a rapidly disappearing blur. With the calm expression of someone who was methodically doing his duty, Detritus picked up a man and used him to hit some other men. When he had a clear area around him and a groaning heap of former rioters, he climbed the heap and cupped his hands around his mouth.
"Listen to me, ye people!"
A troll shouting at the top of his voice could easily be heard above a riot. When he seemed to have their attention, he pulled a scroll out of his breastplate and waved it over his head.
"This is the Riot Act," he said. "You know what that means? It means if an I reads it out and you don't go away, the watch can use deadly force. You understand?"
"Ugh, what did you just use, then?"
moaned someone from underneath his feet.
"That was you helping the watch," said Detritus, shifting his weight.
He unrolled the scroll. Although there was some scuffling in alleyways and shouts from the next street, a ring of silence expanded outwards from the troll. An almost genetic component of the citizens of Ankh Morpork was their ability to spot an opportunity for amusement. Detritus held the document at arm's length. And then, a few inches from his face, he tried turning it round a few times. His lips moved unsteadily. Finally, he leaned down and showed it to Constable Visit.
"What's this word?"
"That's whereby, Sergeant."
"I knew that."
He straightened up again.
"Whereby it is."
Beads of the troll equivalent of sweat began to form on Detritus's forehead.
"Whereby it is acknowledged."
"Acknowledged,"
whispered Constable Visit.
"I knew that."
Detritus stared at the paper again and then gave up.
"You don't want to stand here listening to me all day," he bellowed. "This is the Riot Act and you've all got to read it, right? Pass it round."
"What if we don't read it?"
said a voice in the crowd.
"You've got to read it. It's legal."
"And then what happens?"
"Then I shoot you," said Detritus.
"That's not allowed," said another voice. "You've got to shout, stop, armed watchman, first."
"Sure, that suits me,"
said Detritus. He shrugged one huge shoulder to bring his crossbow under his arm. It was a siege bow, intended to be mounted on the cart. The bolt was 6 feet long.
"It's harder to hit running targets."
He released the safety catch.
"Anyone finishing reading that thing yet?"
"Sergeant!"
Vimes pushed his way through the crowd, and it was a crowd now, Ankh-Morpork was always a good audience. There was a clang as Detritus saluted.
Were you proposing to shoot these people in cold blood, Sergeant?
No, sir. Just a warning shot in the head, sir.
Really? Just give me a moment to talk to them, then.
Vimes looked at the man next to him. He was holding a flaming torch in one hand and a long length of wood in the other. He gave Vimes the nervously defiant stare of someone who has just felt the ground shift under his feet. Vimes pulled the torch towards him and lit a cigar.
What's happening here, friend?
The Clatchians have been shooting people, Mr. Vimes. Unprovoked attack.
Really?
People have been killed.
Who?
Everyone knows they've been killing people.
The man's mental footsteps found safer ground.
What do they think they are? Coming over here.
That's enough, said Vimes. He stood back and raised his voice. I recognize a lot of you, he said, and I know you've got homes to go to. See this?
He pulled his baton of office out of his pocket.
This says I've got to keep the peace. So in 10 seconds I'm going somewhere else to find some peace to keep. But Detritus is going to stay here. And I just hope he doesn't do anything to disgrace the uniform. Or get it very dirty, at least.
Irony was not a degree-level subject among the listeners, but the brighter ones recognized Vimes' expression. It said that here was a man hanging on to his patience by his teeth. The mob dispersed, going ragged at the edges as people legged it down side alleys, threw away their makeshift weapons, and emerged at the other end, walking the grave, thoughtful walk of honest citizens.
All right, what happened? Said Vimes, turning to the troll.
"'We're hearing where this boy shot this man,' said Detritus. "'We got here. Next minute it's raining, people from everywhere shouting.'
"'He smote him, as Hudrun smote the fleshpots of Ur,'
said Constable Visit. Constable Visit the Ungodly with explanatory pamphlets was a good copper, Vimes always said, and that was his highest term of praise. He was an omnian with his countrymen's almost pathological interest in evangelical religion.' and spent all his wages on pamphlets. He even had his own printing press. The results were handed out to anyone interested, and everyone who wasn't interested as well. Even Detritus couldn't clear a crowd faster than Visit, Vimes said. And on his days off, he could be seen tramping the streets with his colleague, Smite the Unbeliever with cunning arguments. So far, they hadn't made a single convert. Vimes thought that Visit was probably a really nice man underneath it all, but somehow he could never face the task of finding out.
"'Smote,' said Vimes, bewildered. "'He killed someone.'
"'Not by the way the man was cursing, sir,' said Detritus. "'Hit him in the arm. His friends brought him round the watch-house to complain. "'He's a baker on the night shift. He said he was late for work. "'He come running in to pick up his dinner. Next minute, he's flat on the floor.'
Vimes walked across the street and tried the door of the shop. It opened a little way, and then fetched up against what seemed to be a barricade. Furniture had been piled up against the window as well.
"'How many people were there, Constable?'
"'A multitude thereof, sir.'
"'And 4 people in here,' thought Vimes. "'A family.' The door moved a fraction, and Vimes realized he was ducking even before the crossbow protruded. There was the thung of the string. The bolt tumbled rather than sped, it corkscrewed wildly across the alley, and was almost moving sideways when it hit the opposite wall.
"'Look,' said Vimes, keeping his body down but raising his voice, "'anyone who got hit with that, it must have been an accident. This is the watch. Open the door, otherwise Detritus will open it, and when he opens the door it stays open, you know what I mean?'
There was no reply.
"'All right. Detritus, just step over here.'
There was a hissed argument inside, and then the sound of scraping as furniture was moved. He tried the door. It swung inwards. The family were at the far end of the room. Vimes felt 8 eyes on him. The atmosphere had a hot, worrying feel, spiced with the smell of burnt food. Mr. Goriff was holding the crossbow gingerly, and the expression on his son's face told Vimes a lot of what he needed to know.
"All right," he said. "Now you all listen to me. I'm not arresting anyone right now, you hear? This sounds like one of those things that make his lordship yawn. But you'd do better spending the rest of the night in the watch-house. I can't spare the men to stand guard here. Do you understand? I could arrest you, but this is just a request."
Mr. Goriff cleared his throat.
"The man I shot,"
he began, and left the question and the lie hanging in the air. Vimes forced himself not to glance at the boy.
"Not badly hurt," he said.
"He... ran in," said Mr. Goriff, "and after last night..."
You thought you were being attacked again and grabbed the crossbow.
Yes, said the boy defiantly before his father could speak. There was a brief argument in Clatchian. Then Mr. Goriff said, We must leave the house.
For your own good. We'll try to have someone watch it. Now get something together and go off with the sergeant. And give me that crossbow.
Goriff handed it over with a look of relief. It was a typical Saturday night special, so badly made and erratic that the only safe place to be when it was fired would be directly behind it. And even then you would be running a risk. And then no one had told its owner that under the counter, in a steamy shop and a perpetual rain of grease, wasn't the best place to keep it strung. The string sagged. Probably the only way you could reliably hurt someone with it was to beat them over the head. Vimes waited until they'd been ushered out and took a last look around the room. It wasn't large. In the kitchen behind the shop, something spicy in a pot was boiling dry. After burning his fingers a couple of times, he managed to tip the pot onto the fire to put it out, and then, vaguely remembering his mother doing something like this, put the pot under the pump to soak. Then he barricaded the windows as best he could and went out, locking the door behind him. A discreetly obvious brass thieves' guild plaque over the door told the world that Mr. Goriff had conscientiously paid his annual fee and would not therefore be officially burgled. Ankh-Morpork had a very direct approach to the idea of insurance. When the middleman was cut out, that wasn't a figure of speech. But the world had plenty of less formal dangers, and so Vimes took a piece of chalk out of his pocket and wrote on the door, Under the protection of the watch. As an afterthought, he signed it, Sergeant Detritus. In the imaginations of the less civically minded, the majesty of the rule of law didn't carry anything like as much weight as the dread of Detritus. The Riot Act. Where the hell had he dredged that from? Carrot, probably. It hadn't been used for as long as Vimes could remember, and that was no wonder when you knew what it really did. Even Vetinari would hesitate to use it. Now it was nothing more than a phrase. Thank goodness for trollish illiteracy. It was when Vimes stood back to admire his handiwork that he saw the glow in the sky over Park Lane almost at the same time as he heard the clatter of iron boots on the street.
"Oh, hello, little bottom," he said. "What now? Don't tell me. Someone set fire to the Clatchian embassy."
"All right, sir," said the dwarf. She stood uncertainly in the middle of the alley, looking worried.
"Well," said Vimes.
You said..."
With a sinking feeling, Vimes remembered that the generic dwarfish skill with iron was matched only by the fumble-fingered grasp of irony.
"The Clatchian embassy is really on fire."
"Yes, sir."
Mrs. Spent opened the door a crack.
"Yes?"
"I'm a friend of..." Carrot hesitated, wondering if Fred would have given his real name.
"Big fat man, suit doesn't fit."
"The one who goes around with the sex maniac?"
"Pardon?"
"Skinny little twerp, dresses like a clown?"
"They said you'd have a room," said Carrot desperately.
"They've got it,"
said Mrs. Spent, trying to shut the door.
"They said I could use it."
"No subletting."
"They said I should pay you $2.
The pressure of the door was released a little.
"On top of what they paid?"
said Mrs. Spent.
"Of course."
"Well..."
She looked Carrot up and down and sniffed.
"All right. What shift are you on?"
"Sorry?"
"You're a watchman, right?"
Carrot hesitated and then raised his voice.
"No, I am not a watchman. Ha 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 ha! You think I'm a watchman? Do I look like a watchman?"
"Yes, you do," said Mrs. Spent. "You're Captain Carrot. I've seen you walking about the town. Still, I suppose even coppers have to sleep somewhere."
On the roof, Angua rolled her eyes.
"No women, no cooking, no music, no pets," said Mrs. Spent as she led the way up the creaking stairs.
Angua waited in the dark until she heard the window open.
"She's gone,"
Carrot hissed.
"There's glass on the tiles out here, just like Fred reported,"
said Angua, as she swung herself over the sill. Inside the room, she took a deep breath and shut her eyes. First, she had to forget the smell of Carrot, anxious sweat, soap, the lingering hints of armour polish. And Fred Colon, all perspiration with a hint of beer, and then the odd ointment Nobby used for his skin condition, and the smells of feet, bodies, clothes, polish, fingernails. After an hour, it was possible for the eye of the nose to see someone walk across the room, frozen in time by their smell.
but after a day, smells crisscrossed and entangled. You had to take them apart, remove the familiar pieces, and what you had left...
Oh, they're so mixed up.
All right, said Carrot soothingly. At least three people, but I think one of them is Ossie. It's stronger round the bed, and... She opened her eyes wide and looked down at the floor. Somewhere here.
What? What is?
Angua crouched down with her nose just above the floorboards.
I can smell it, but I can't see it.
A knife appeared in front of her. Carrot got down on his knees and ran the blade along the dust-filled crack between the floorboards. Something splintery and brown popped up. It had been trodden on and rolled underfoot, but at this distance even Carrot could pick up traces of the clove smell.
Do you think Ossie made a lot of apple pies? He whispered. No cooking, remember? Said Angua, and grinned. There's something else.
Carrot levered out more dirt and dust. In it, something glittered.
Fred said all the glass was outside, didn't he?
Yes. Well, supposing we assume that someone didn't pick up all the bits when they broke in.
For someone that doesn't like lying, Carrot, you can be quite devious, you know.
Just logical. There's glass outside the window, but all that means is that there is glass outside the window. Commander Vimes always says there's no such things as clues. It's how you look at them.
You think someone broke in and then carefully put the glass outside? Could be. Carrot? Why are we whispering?
No women, remember?
And no pets, said Angua. So she's got me coming and going.
Don't look like that, she added when she saw his face. It's only bad taste if someone else says it. I'm allowed. Carrot scratched up some more glass fragments. Angua looked under the bed and pulled out the battered magazines.
Ye gods, do people really read this stuff? She said, flicking through bows and ammo. Testing the Loxley Reflex 7, a whole lot of bow. Footsore, we test the 10 best caltrops. And what's this magazine? Warrior of Fortune.
There's always little wars somewhere, said Carrot, pulling out the box of money.
But will you look at the size of this axe here? Get a head, get a burly and strong in the arm street sweeper, and win by a neck.
Well, it must be true what they say about men who like big weapons.
And that is, said Carrot, lifting the lid of the box.
She looked up at the top of his head. As always, Carrot radiated innocence like a small sun. But
they're rather small, she said.
Oh, that's true, said Carrot, picking up some of the Clatchian coins. Look at dwarfs, never happier than with a chopper the same size as them. And Nobby's fascinated by weapons, and he's practically dwarf-sized.
Technically, Angua was sure she knew Carrot better than anyone else.
She was pretty sure he cared a lot for her. He seldom said so, he just assumed that she knew. She'd known other men, although turning into a wolf for part of the month was one of those little flaws that could put any normal man off, and up until Carrot always had. And she knew the sort of things men said in what might be called the heat of the moment and then forgot. But when Carrot said things, you knew that he felt that everything was now settled until further notice. So if she made any comment, he'd be genuinely surprised that she'd forgotten what it was he had said, and would probably quote date and time. And yet all the time there was this feeling that the greater part of him was always deep, deep inside, looking out. No one could be so simple, no one could be so creatively dumb, without being very intelligent. It was like being an actor. Only a very good actor was any good at being a bad actor.
"Rather a lonely person, our Nobby," said Carrot.
"Well, yes. But I'm sure he'll find the right person for him," Carrot added cheerfully.
"Probably in a bottle," said Angua to herself.
She remembered the conversation with him. It was a terrible thing to think, but there was something itchy about the thought of Nobby being allowed in the gene pool, even at the shallow end.
"You know, these coins are odd," said Carrot.
"How do you mean?" said Angua, grateful for the distraction.
"Why would he be paid in Clatchian walls? He wouldn't be able to spend them here, and the money changers don't give very good rates."
Carrot tossed a coin in the air and caught it.
"When we were leaving, Mr. Vimes said to me, 'Make sure you find the bunch of dates and the camel hidden under the pillow.' I think I know what he meant."
"Sand on the floor," said Angua. "Now, isn't that an obvious clue?" You can tell they were Clatchians because of the sand in their sandals.
But these clothes, Carrot prodded the little bud, it's not as if it's a common habit even among Clatchians. That's not a very obvious clue, is it?
It smells newer, said Angua. I'd say he was here last night.
After Ossie was dead?
Yes.
Why?
How should I know? What kind of name is 71-hour Ahmed? Said Angua. Carrot shrugged. I don't know. I think Mr. Vimes thinks that someone in Ankh-Morpork wants us to believe that Clatchians paid to have the prince killed. That sounds nasty, but logical. But I don't understand why a real Clatchian would get involved. Their eyes met.
Politics, they said together.
For enough money, a lot of people would do anything, said Angua. There was a sudden and ferocious knocking at the door.
Have you got someone in there? Said Mrs. Spent.
Out of the window, said Carrot. Why don't I just stay and rip her throat out? Said Angua.
All right, it was a joke, all right, she said, swinging her legs over the sill. Ankh-Morpork no longer had a fire brigade. The citizens had a rather disturbingly direct way of thinking at times, and it didn't take long for people to see the rather obvious flaw in paying a group of people by the number of fires they put out. The penny really dropped shortly after Charcoal Tuesday. Since then, they had relied on the good old principle of enlightened self-interest. People living close to a burning building did their best to douse the fire, because the thatch they saved might be their own. But the crowd watching the burning embassy were doing so in a hollow-eyed, distant way, as if it was all taking place on some distant planet. They moved aside automatically as Vimes elbowed his way through to the space in front of the gates. Flames were already licking from every ground-floor window, and they could make out scurrying silhouettes in the flickering light. He turned to the crowd.
"Come on, what's up with you? Get a bucket chain going!"
"It's their bloody embassy," said a voice.
"Yes, Clatchian soil, right?"
"Can't go on Clatchian soil. That'd be an invasion, that would."
"They wouldn't let us,"
said a small boy holding a bucket. Vimes looked at the embassy gateway. There were a couple of guards. Their worried glances kept going back from the fire behind them to the crowd in front. They were nervous men, but it was much worse than that, because they were nervous men holding big swords. He advanced on them, trying to smile, and holding his badge out in front of him. It had a shield on it. It was not a very big shield.
"Commander Vimes, Ankh-Morpork City Watch," he said, in what he hoped was a helpful and friendly voice.
A guard waved him away.
"You'll be off."
"Ah," said Vimes. He looked down at the cobbles of the gateway and then back up at the guard. Some were in the flames, someone was screaming.
"You, come here. You see this?"
he shouted at the guard, pointing down. The man took a hesitant step forward.
"That's Ankh-Morpork soil down there, my friend," said Vimes, "and you're standing on it and you're obstructing me in my..."
He rammed his fist as hard as he could into the guard's stomach.
"Duty!"
He was already kicking out as the other guard rushed him. He caught him on the knee. Something went click. It felt like Vimes's own ankle. Cursing and limping slightly, he ran on into the embassy and caught a scurrying man by his robe.
"Are there still people in there? Are there people in there?"
The man gave Vimes a panicky look. The armfuls of paper he'd been carrying spilled onto the ground. Someone else grabbed his shoulder.
"Can you climb, Mr. Vimes?"
"Who are you?"
The newcomer turned to the cowering paper carrier and struck him heavily across the face.
"Rescuer of paper!"
As the man fell back, his turban was snatched from his head.
"This way!"
The figure plunged off through the smoke. Vimes hurried after him until they reached a wall with a drainpipe attached.
"How did you...
up, up!"
Vimes put one foot in the man's cupped hands, managed to get the other one on a bracket and forced himself upwards.
"Hurry!"
He managed to half-climb, half-pull himself up the pipe, little fireworks of pain exploding up and down his leg, as he reached a parapet and hauled himself over. The other man rose behind him, as if he'd run up the wall. There was a strip of cloth hiding the lower half of his face. He thrust another strip towards Vimes.
"Across your nose and mouth," he commanded, "for the smoke."
It was boiling across the roof. Beside Vimes, a chimney pot gushed a roaring tongue of flame. The rest of the unwound turban was thrust into his hands.
"You take this side, I'll take the other,"
said the apparition, and darted away again into the smoke.
"But who..."
Vimes could feel the heat through his boots. He edged away across the roof and heard the shouting coming from below. When he leaned over the edge here, he could see the window some way below him. Someone had smashed a pane because a hand was waving.
there was more commotion down in the courtyard. Amid a press of figures, he could make out the huge shape of Constable Dorfel, a golem, and quite definitely fireproof. But Dorfel was bad enough at stairs as it was. There weren't many that could take the weight. The hand in the smoke stopped waving. Vimes looked down again.
"Can you fly, Mr. Vimes?"
He looked at the chimney, belching flame. He looked at the unwound turban. A lot of Sam Vimes's brain had shut down, although the bits relaying the twinges of pain from his legs were operating with distressing efficiency. But there were still some thoughts operating down around the core, and they delivered for his consideration the insight, tough-looking cloth. He looked back at the chimney. It looked stout enough. The window was about 6 feet below. Vimes began to move automatically. So, purely theoretically, if a man were to wrap one end of the cloth round the belching stack like this, and pay it out like this, and lower himself over the parapet like this, and kick himself away from the wall like this, then when he swung back again, his feet ought to be able to smash his way through the other panes of the window like this. A cart squeaked along the wet street. Its progress was erratic, because no two of its wheels were the same size, so it rocked and wobbled and skidded and probably involved more effort to pull than it saved overall, especially since its contents appeared to be rubbish. But then so did its owner, who was about the size of a man, but bent almost double and was covered with hair, or rags, or quite possibly a matted mixture of both, that was so felted and unwashed that small plants had taken root on it. If the thing had stopped walking and crouched down, it would have given an astonishingly good impression of a long-neglected compost heap. As it walked along, it snuffled. A foot was stuck out to impede its progress.
"Good evening, Stooley," said Carrot as the cart halted.
The heap stopped. Part of it tilted upwards.
"Get off,"
it muttered from somewhere in the thatch. "Now, now, Stooley, let's help one another, shall we? You help me and I'll help you."
"Bugger off, Captain."
"Will you tell me things I want to know," said Carrot, "and I won't search your cart."
"I hate gnolls," said Angua. "They smell awful."
"Oh, that's hardly fair. The streets would be a lot dirtier without you and yours, eh, Stooley?" said Carrot, still speaking quite pleasantly. "You pick up this, you pick up that. Maybe bash it against a wall until it stops struggling."
"It's a vile accuracy,"
said the gnoll. There was a bubbling noise that might have been a chuckle. "So I'm hearing you might know where Snowy Slopes is these days," said Carrot.
I don't know, nothing."
"Fine." Carrot produced a three-tined garden fork and walked round to the cart, which dripped.
I don't know nothing about,
said the gnoll quickly. "Yes," said Carrot, fork poised.
"Don't know nothing about in the sweet shop, in Money Trip Lane."
"The one with the rooms to let sign?"
"Right."
"Well done. Thank you for being a good citizen," said Carrot. "Incidentally, we passed a dead seagull on the way here. It's in Brewer Street. I bet if you hurried, you could beat the rush."
"Hut diggity,"
snuffled the gnoll. The cart started to judder forward. The watchman watched it lurch and scrape around the corner. "They're good fellows at heart," said Carrot. "I think it says a lot for the spirit of tolerance in this city that even gnolls can call it home."
"They turn my stomach," said Angua, as they set off again. "That one had plants growing on him."
"Mr. Vimes says we ought to do something for them," said Carrot.
"All heart, that man."
"With a flamethrower, he says."
"Wouldn't work. Too soggy. Has anyone ever really found out what they eat?"
"It's better to think of them as cleaners. You certainly don't see as much rubbish and dead animals on the streets as you used to."
"Yes, but have you ever seen a gnoll with a brush and a shovel?"
"Well, that's society for you, I'm afraid," said Carrot. "Everything is dumped on the people below until you find someone who's prepared to eat it. That's what Mr. Vimes says."
"Yes," said Angua.
They walked in silence for a while, and then she said, "You care a lot about what Mr. Vimes says, don't you? He is a fine officer and an example to us all.
And you've never thought of getting a job in Quirm or somewhere, have you? The other city's a head-hunting Ankh-Morpork watchman now."
"What? Leave Ankh-Morpork?" The tone of voice included the answer.
"No, I suppose not," said Angua sadly.
"Anyway, I don't know what Mr. Vimes would do without me running around all the time."
"It's a point of view, certainly," said Angua.
It wasn't far to Money Trap Lane. It was in a ghetto of what Lord Rust would probably call skilled artisans, the people too low down the social scale to be movers and shakers, but slightly too high to be easily moved or shook. The sanders and polishers, generally. The people who hadn't got very much but were proud even of that. There were little clues. Shiny house numbers, for a start. And on the walls of houses that were effectively just one long continuous row, after centuries of building and in-building, very careful boundaries in the paint where people had brushed up to the very border of their property and not a gnat's blink to each side. Carrot always said it showed the people were the kind who instinctively realized that civilization was based on a shared respect for ownership. Angua thought they were just tight little bastards who'd sell you the time of day. Carrot walked noiselessly down the alley beside the sweet shop. There was a rough wooden staircase going up to the first floor. He pointed silently to the midden below it. It seemed to consist almost entirely of bottles.
"Big drinker?" Angua mouthed.
Carrot shook his head. She crouched down and looked at the labels, but her nose was already giving her a hint. Dibbler's homeopathic shampoo. Mere and Stingbat's herbal wash, with herbs. Rinse and run scalp tonic, with extra herbs. There were others. Herbs, she thought. Chuck a handful of weeds in the pot and you've got herbs. Carrot was starting up the stairs when she put her hand on his shoulder. There was another smell. It was the one that drove through all the other scents of the streets like a spear. It was one that a werewolf's nose is particularly attuned to. He nodded and went carefully to the door. Then he pointed down. There was a stain under the gap. Carrot drew his sword and kicked the door open. Daceyville Slopes hadn't taken his condition lightly. Bottles of all shapes and colours occupied most flat surfaces, giving testimony to the alchemist's art and humanity's optimism. The suds of his latest experiment were still in a bowl on the table, and his body on the floor had a towel around his neck. The watchman looked down at it. Snowy had cleaned, washed, and gone.
"I think we can say life is extinct," said Carrot.
"Yuck," said Angua. She grabbed the open shampoo bottle and sniffed deeply. The sickly scent of marinated herbs assailed her sinuses, but anything was better than the sharp, beguiling smell of blood. "I wonder where his head is at," said Carrot, in a determinedly matter-of-fact voice. "Oh, it's rolled over there. What's the horrible smell?"
"This," Angua flourished the shampoo. $4 a bottle, it says. "Shit."
Angua took another deep sniff at the herbal goo to drown out the call of the wolf.
"Doesn't look as if they stole anything," said Carrot, "unless they were very neat. What's the matter?"
"Don't ask." She managed to get a window open and sucked down great draughts of comparatively fresh air, while Carrot went through the corpse's pockets.
"You can't tell if there's a clove around, can you?" he said. "Carrot, please, this is a room with blood all over the floor. Have you any idea?" "Excuse me."
She rushed out and down the steps. The alley had the generic smell of all alleys everywhere, overlaid on the basic, all-embracing smell of the city. But at least it didn't make your hair grow and your teeth try to lengthen. She leaned against the wall and fought for control.
"Shampoo?"
She could have saved Snowy a hell of a lot of money with just one careful bite. Then he'd know all about a really bad hair day. Carrot came down a couple of minutes later, locking the door behind him.
"Are you feeling better?"
"A bit." "There was something else," said Carrot, looking thoughtful. "I think he wrote a note before he died, but it's all rather odd." He waved in the air what looked like a cheap notepad.
"This needs careful looking at."
He shook his head. "Poor old Snowy."
"He was a killer."
"Yes, but that's a nasty way to die."
"Decapitation? With a very sharp sword, by the look of it. I can think of worse."
"Yes, but I can't help thinking that if only the chap had better hair or had found the right shampoo at an early age, he'd have led a different life."
"Well, at least he won't have to worry about dandruff anymore."
"That was a little tasteless."
"Sorry, but you know how blood makes me tense."
"Your hair always looks amazing," said Carrot, changing the subject, with Angua thought unusual tact. "I don't know what you use, but it's a shame he never tried it."
"I doubt he went to the right shop," said Angua. "It says, for a glossy coat, on the bottles I usually buy."
"What's the matter?"
"Can you smell smoke?" said Carrot.
"Carrot, it's going to be 5 minutes before I can smell anything, except..." But he was staring past her at the big red glow in the sky. Vimes coughed, and then coughed some more, and eventually opened his streaming eyes in the confident expectation of seeing his own lungs in front of him.
"Glass of water, Mr. Vimes?"
Vimes peered through the tears at the shifting shape of Fred Colon.
"Thanks, Fred. What's the horrible burning smell?" "It's you, sir."
Vimes was sitting on a low wall outside the wreck of the embassy. Cool air washed around him. He felt like underdone beef. The heat was radiating off him.
"You was passed on for a while there, sir," said Sergeant Colon, helpfully. "But everyone saw you swing in that window, sir, and you threw that woman out for detritus to catch. That'll be a feather in your cap and no mistake, sir. I bet the raghead, Clatchians'll be giving you the Order of the Camel or something for this night's work, sir."
Colon beamed, bursting with pride by association.
"A feather in my cap," murmured Vimes.
He undid his helmet and, with a certain amount of exhausted delight, saw that every single plume had been burnt to a stub. He blinked slowly.
"What about the man, Fred? Did he get out?"
"What man?"
"There was..."
Vimes blinked again. Various parts of his body, aware that he hadn't been taking calls, were ringing in to complain.
"There had been some man.
Vimes had landed on a bed or something, and there was a woman clutching at him, and he had smashed out at what was left of the window, seen the big, broad, and above all strong arms of detritus down below, and had thrown her out as politely as the circumstances allowed. Then the man from the roof had come out of the smoke again, carrying another figure over his shoulder, screaming something at him, and beckoned him to follow, and then the floor had given way.
"There were two other people in there," he said, coughing again.
"They didn't get out the front way, then," said Colon.
"How did I get out?" said Vimes. "Oh, Dorfel was stamping on the fire below, sir. Very handy, a ceramic constable. You landed right on him, so of course he stopped what he was doing and brought you out. It's going to be handshakes and buns all round in the morning, sir."
There weren't any right now, Vimes noted. There were still plenty of people around, carrying bundles, putting out small fires, arguing with one another. But there was a big hole where the congratulating the hero of the hour should have been.
"Oh, everyone's always a bit preoccupied after something like this, sir," said Colon, as if reading his thoughts.
"I think I'll have a nice cold bath," said Vimes to the world in general, "and then some sleep. Sybil's got some wonderful ointment for burns. Oh, hello, you two."
"We saw the fire," Carrot began running up. "Is it all over?"
"Mr. Vimes saved the day," said Sergeant Colon excitedly. "Just went straight in and saved everyone, in the finest tradition of the watch."
"Fred," said Vimes wearily.
"Yes, sir."
Fred, the finest tradition of the watch, is having a quiet smoke somewhere out of the wind at 3 a.m. Let's not get carried away, eh? Colon looked crestfallen.
"Well," he began.
Vimes staggered to his feet and patted his sergeant on the back.
"Oh, all right, it's a tradition," he conceded. "You can do the next one, Fred. And now," he steadied himself as he stood up, "I'm going down to the yard to write my report."
"You're covered in ash and you're swaying," said Carrot. "I should just get on home, sir."
"Oh, no," said Vimes. "Got to do the paperwork. Anyone know the time?"
"Bingly, bingly, bingly, beep,"
said a cheerful voice from his pocket.
"Damn,"
said Vimes, but it was too late.
"It is,"
said the voice, which had the squeaky, friendly quality that begs to be strangled.
"About nine-ish."
"Nine-ish?"
"Yep. Nine-ish. Precisely about nine-ish."
Vimes rolled his eyes.
"Precisely about nine-ish," he said, pulling a small box out of his pocket and opening the lid.
The demon inside gave him an angry look.
"Yesterday you said,"
it said,
"that if I, and I quote, didn't stop all that 8:56 and 6 seconds precisely business, I would be looking at a hammer from below. And when I said, Mr. Insert Name Here, that this would invalidate my warranty, you said that I could take my warranty and shove—"
"I thought you'd lost that thing," said Carrot.
"Ha!"
said the disorganizer.
"Really? You thought he did? I don't call putting something in your trouser pockets just before they go into the wash losing it."
"That was an accident," muttered Vimes.
Oh, and dropping me in the dragon's feeding bowl, that was accidental too, was it?"
The demon mumbled to itself for a moment and then said,
"Anyway, do you want to know your appointments for this evening?"
Vimes looked at the smouldering wreckage of the embassy.
"Do tell," he said.
"You don't have any," said the demon sulkily. "You haven't told me any."
"You see," said Vimes, "that's what drives me livid. Why should I have to tell you? Why didn't you tell me, eight-ish, break up riot at mundane meals and stop detritus shooting people, eh?"
"You didn't tell me to tell you."
"I didn't know. And that's how real life works. How can I tell you to warn me about things that no one knows are going to happen?" "If you were any good, that'd be your job."
"He writes in the manual," said the demon nastily. "Did you know that, everybody? He writes in the manual."
"Well, of course, I make notes."
"He's actually sneakily trying to keep his diary in the manual so his wife won't find out he's never bothered to learn how to use me," said the demon.
"What about the Vimes manual, then?" snapped Vimes. "I notice you've never bothered to learn how to use me." The demon hesitated.
"Humans come with a manual," it said.
"It'd be a damn good idea," said Vimes.
"True," murmured Angua.
"It could say things like, Chapter 1, Bingley, Bingley, Beep, and other damn fool things to spring on people at 6 in the morning, said Vimes, his eyes wild. "And troubleshooting. My owner keeps trying to drop me in the privy. What am I doing wrong?" And Carrot patted him gently on the back.
"I should sign off now, sir," he said gently. "It's been a busy few days."
Vimes rubbed his forehead. "I dare say I could do with the rest," he said. "Come on, there's nothing more to see here. Let's go home."
"I thought you said you weren't going," Carrot began, but Vimes's mind was already scolding him.
"I meant the yard, of course," he said. "I'll go home afterwards."
A ball of lamplight floated through the Ramkin library, drifting across the shelves of huge leather-bound books. Many of them had never been read, Sybil knew.
Various ancestors had simply ordered them from the engravers and put them on the shelves because a library was something you had to have, don't you know? Like a stable yard and a servant's wing and some ghastly landscaping mistake created by bloody stupid Johnson. Although in the latter case her grandfather had shot the man before he could do any real damage. She held the lamp higher. Ramkins looked down their noses at her from their frames through the brown varnish of the centuries. Portraits were another thing that had been collected out of unregarded habit. Most of them were men. They were invariably in armour and always on horseback, and every single one of them had fought the sworn enemies of Ankh Morpork. In recent times this had been quite difficult, and her grandfather, for example, had to lead an expedition all the way to Hawanderland in order to find some sworn enemies, although there was an adequate supply and a lot of swearing by the time he left. Earlier, of course, it had been a lot easier. Ramkin regiments had fought the city's enemies all over the Stowe Plains, and had inflicted heroic casualties, quite often on people in the opposing armies. It is a long-cherished tradition among a certain type of military thinker that huge casualties are the main thing. If they're on the other side, then this is a valuable bonus. There were a few women among the sitters, none of them holding anything heavier than a glove or a small pet dragon. Their job had largely been to roll bandages and await the return of their husbands with, she likes to think, resolution and fortitude and a general hope that said husbands would return with as many of their bits as possible. The point was, though, that they never thought about it. There was a war and off they went. If there wasn't a war, they looked for one. They didn't even use words like duty. It was all built in, at bone level. She sighed. It was all so difficult these days, and Lady Sybil came from a class that was not used to difficulty, or at least the kind that couldn't be sorted out by shouting at a servant. 500 years ago, one of her ancestors had cut off a Clatchian's head in battle, and had brought it home on a pole, and no one thought any the worse of him, given what the Clatchians would have cut off if they'd caught him. That seemed straightforward. You fought them, they fought you. Everyone knew the rules, and if you got your head cut off, you jolly well didn't blub about it afterwards. Certainly things were better now, but they were just more difficult. And of course some of those antique husbands were away for months or years at a time, and for them wives and families were pretty much like the library and stable yard and the Johnson exploding pagoda. You got them sorted out and then didn't think much about it. At least Sam was home every day. Well, most days. Every night, anyway. Well, part of most nights, certainly. At least they ate meals together. Well, most meals.
Well, at least they made a start on most meals. Well, at least she knew he was never very far away, just somewhere where he was trying to do too much and run too fast and people were trying to kill him. All in all, she considered she was jolly lucky.
Vimes stared at Carrot, who was standing in front of his desk. "So, what does all that add up to?" he said. "The man we know didn't get the prince is dead. The man who probably did is dead. Someone tried very clumsily to make it look as if Ossie was paid by the Clatchians. Okay, I can see why someone might want to do that. That's what Fred calls politics. They get Snowy to do the real business, and he helps poor dumb Ossie, who's there to take the fall, and then the watch proves that Ossie was in the pay of the Clatchians, and that's another reason for fighting. And Snowy just slopes off, only someone cured his dandruff for him."
"After he'd written something, sir," said Carrot.
"Ah, yes." Vimes looked at the notepad retrieved from Snowy's room. It was a crude affair, the wads of mismatched bits of scrap that the engravers sold off cheaply. He sniffed at it. "Soap on the edges," he said.
"His new shampoo," said Carrot. "First time he'd used it."
"How do you know?"
"We looked at all the bottles on the heap, sir."
"Hmm. Looks like fresh blood here at the spine where they're stitched together."
"His, sir," said Angua.
Vimes nodded. You never argued with Angua about blood.
"But none of the actual pages have blood on them," said Vimes, "which is a bit odd. Messy business, decapitation. People tend to, spray. So the top page..."
"Has been taken away, sir," said Carrot, grinning and nodding. "But that's not the funny part, sir. See if you can guess, sir."
Vimes glared at him and then moved the lamp closer.
"Very faint impression of writing on the top page," he muttered. "Can't make it out."
"We can't either, sir. We know he wrote in pencil, sir. There was one on the table."
"Very faint traces," said Vimes. "Blokes like Snowy write as though they're chipping stone." He flicked the notebook. "Someone tore out not just the page he'd written on, but several below it as well."
"Clever, eh, sir? Everyone knows..."
"You can read the suspicious note by looking at the marks on the page below," said Vimes. He tossed the book on the table again.
"Hmm. There's a message there, yes."
"Perhaps he was blackmailing whoever's behind all this," said Angua.
"That's not his style," said Vimes.
"No, what I meant was..."
There was a knock on the door, and Fred Colon entered.
"Brung ye a mug of coffee," he said, "and there's a bunch of Clatchians to see you downstairs, Mr. Vimes. Probably come to give you a medal and gabble at you in their lingo. And if you're on for late supper, Mrs. Gorriff's doing goat and rice and foreign gravy."
"I suppose I'd better go down and see them," said Vimes, "but I haven't even had time for a wash."
"That's evidence of your heroic endeavours," said Colon stoutly.
"Oh, all right."
Unease began about halfway down the stairs. Vimes had never run into a group of citizens wishing to give him a medal, and so he did not have a lot of experience on this score, but the group waiting for him in a tight cluster near the sergeant's desk did not look like a committee of welcome. They were Clatchian. At least they were wearing foreign-looking clothes, and one or two of them had caught more sun than you generally got in Ankh-Morpork. The feeling crept over Vimes that Clatch was a very big place, in which his city and the whole of the Stowe Plains would be lost. And so there must be room in it for all kinds of peoples, including this short chap in the red fez, who was practically vibrating with indignation.
"Are you the man Vimes?"
the enfezed one demanded.
"Well, I'm Commander Vimes. We demand the release of the Gorriff family, and we won't take any excuses."
Vimes blinked.
"Release? You have locked them up and confiscated their shop."
Vimes stared at the man, and then he looked across the room at Sergeant Detritus.
"Where did you put the family, Sergeant?"
Detritus saluted.
"In the cell, sir."
"Aha!" said the man in the fez. "You admit it!"
"Excuse me, who are you?" said Vimes, blinking with tiredness.
"I don't have to tell you, and you can't beat it out of me," said the man, sticking out his chest.
"Oh, thank you for telling me," said Vimes. "I do hate wasted effort."
"Oh, hello, Mr. Wazir," said Carrot, appearing behind Vimes. "Did you get the note about that book?"
There was one of those silences that happen when everyone has to reprogram their faces. Then Vimes said,
"What?"
"Mr. Wazir sells books in Widdy Street," said Carrot. "Only I asked him for..."